Welcome back to the Brexit Brits Abroad podcast. I'm Dr. Michaela Benson, a reader in sociology at Goldsmiths, University of London, and the research lead for a UK and a Changing Europe funded project that's all about what Brexit means for British citizens living in the EU27. Today, I'm joined by Lorenza Antonucci, who is a Birmingham Fellow at the University of Birmingham, which is a lectureship, and Simone Variali, who is a lecturer at the University of Lincoln. And actually, I've known both of you for quite a long time. I realised when I was thinking back along this. They've written an excellent paper in the journal Current Sociology that I've brought them here to talk about today. And the title of the paper is Unequal Europe, Unequal Brexit. And I think it's a very ambitious paper. Do you want to start by telling me a little bit about what you were trying to do in the paper?
Thank you very much for this. So what were we trying to do? I guess when we met, we were kind of concerned with two different narratives about Brexit, which kind of connected in terms of understanding how Brexit relates to inequalities in Europe more generally. So one narrative was about Brexit as a kind of result of the EU sort of constraining the economic and political opportunities for the UK. And then there was another narrative, which is about European migrants, which was about, well, either European migrants are white middle-class migrants, or, and this is perhaps especially after the enlargements, European migrants are either West European professionals or East European lower-skilled workers. And so the idea was to try to understand basically, okay, we know that this distinction between Westerners and Eastern populations is connected to inequalities in Europe, but then how these inequalities intersect with other inequalities in the biographies of actually non-UK EU citizens, but also European migrants more generally, because we are focusing on the UK, but I think the argument actually has implications beyond the UK.
I would add that I think the surprising thing when we started this work was that we were reading lots of work on inequality in relation to Brexit, and that they scarcely even mention EU migrants, EU migration more generally. And that was surprising because one of the first reasons why people voted for Brexit, one of the first reasons why Brexit was called for was the access of EU migrants to social rights. So clearly EU migration was a big topic in the British debate on Brexit, but it wasn't mentioned, especially, for example, the British Journal of Sociology special issue. EU migrants are mentioned only once by Gurminder as a citation on somebody else's work. So most of the analysis focused on British explanations of why people voted for Brexit. You know, some work I also published on this, but not really connected with the issue of the relationship between the UK and Europe, which is very much the topic of Brexit. Brexit is very much about the relationship, you know, between UK and Europe. So what is about this relationship between the UK and Europe that is not being discussed? And so one thing is the positionality of the UK within Europe. So this puts, you know, into perspective the fact that British people voted, you know, to get out the European project. It's important to understand what was their role within the European project. And also this also clarifies the role of EU migrants with, you know, in the UK, which sometimes, you know, in the, especially in the mainstream coverages, you can see an assumption that they are all middle class, or that they come from a more privileged part of Europe, or there is no understanding of, you know, why these people are moving from certain parts of Europe to the UK. So that was a starting point.
I think that you've kind of already identified quite a few different things there, because I think that there is, strangely, within the sociological literature, there isn't actually huge amounts on intra-EU migration anyway, even before migration. And so that might also explain some of the issues. But also that idea of not really understanding the different stakes of different European countries actually within the European project and how Britain was complicit within that, or where Britain was located in respect to that, I think is really interesting. And I think really what you're trying to do through that discussion, through focusing on those EU migrants in the UK, is actually to use them as a way of saying, well, this is a really interesting way of us reshaping that discussion about Brexit and actually asking again, you know, Brexit as related to Britain's relationship to Europe rather than Brexit as a distinctly British problem.
Yeah, I was also thinking that connects with the issue of meritocracy. So I think the paper also comes from the fact that coming both from Italy to the UK, for us, the idea of the UK as this country connected with the myth of meritocracy, so the idea that you basically move to the UK to have a career, to have a better income, so that the UK kind of stands for a certain culture, a more open, modern culture. I think these ideas was very familiar to us. So even in terms of our own social biography, that's a perspective of Brexit that, I mean, in a sense, it shapes your life and it shaped our lives well before Brexit. So I think that it also coming from that more kind of personal positionality.
So Britain has seen through the eyes, well, of European migrants, essentially, and what Britain represented and stood for.
Yeah, I would say Southern Europeans, I know from the literature about European migrants that Eastern Europeans also have similar expectations, attitudes about the UK. I don't want to generalize too much because I think this is also very, I mean, I was having a conversation with a colleague about this article a couple of years ago, and she said, you guys don't mention Portugal, which made me think about how basically maybe this is also a very Italian story in a sense. But then when you look at the literature, there are shared commonality in terms of what the UK stands for EU migrants.
What we try to do in the article is to connect some of the literature on the EU migrants. As you said, EU migration is not particularly developed, but still, there is an increasing number of, work on this topic. But it didn't enter into the more mainstream debates on Brexit inequality. That was the main thing. So when we talk about Brexit inequality, we always refer either to class, social class, or race. But the specific, element of core periphery inequality, so the position of countries within the EU project, was not put into the mainstream debate, and because this is what we're trying to do. So we didn't want to write an article that was like on migration. But also, I'm not, a migration specialist in any way, so it's not my topic. But I'm interested in how migration explains some of the bigger dynamics of inequality in relation to Brexit, basically.
I think that's really important, and I really liked that shift of the spatial focus of Brexit, I suppose, to a bigger geography and to a geography that relocates Britain in relation to Europe and points out that there are issues that we need to attend to when we're thinking about inequalities, as you point out, that go beyond, I think, the kind of the very well-trodden tropes of what is a fundamentally national project of sociology. British sociology is a national project, essentially, which then doesn't really necessarily extend beyond its known threads in this way. So the known thread at the moment, obviously, about class, which is very prominent in sociology. And in the lead up to Brexit, that was probably the biggest theme in British sociology. I could wax lyrical about that for a while. And the very welcome kind of recognition, actually, of the pervasive racism and xenophobia in Britain and how that contributed towards the Brexit referendum. But then I think that that's a little bit at odds with some of those kind of rather curious interpretations of that could say, for example, well, EU migrants were always privileged. So why should we, they're just having their privileges taken away from them, rather than these EU migrants are actually caught up in these border regimes in quite different ways. And their experiences are also not uniform.
Yes.
No, yeah, I mean, I totally agree. And to expand on what Lorenzo was saying before, there is also the issue that there is a massive literature on intra-European mobilities, but then that literature is not very much about inequalities, partly because of this assumption that EU mobile citizens, so to speak, they do mobilities, they don't do migrations, because they have legal privilege and because they are white or they are Western white. So there is that kind of double privilege. So there was, in a sense, we thought it was important to intervene in that debate to connect European migrations and to call them migrations, actually, and connect them to wider inequalities within Europe, which also, going back to the question of British sociology, is not really a big topic in British sociology. Europe isn't really a topic, and an equal Europe is certainly not a topic. So you won't find a connection between Europe and debates about class. Race is a bit different, of course, because Europe connects to an important literature about Eurocentrism, about colonialism, but that in that case you don't have a discussion about an equal Europe. So again, we thought there was a gap.
My feeling as somebody who has worked on intra-EU migrations, which I've always called migrations, even though people have told me not to, has been that one of the issues has, when talking about those movements within the European Union, has been that they've actually reproduced some of the very exclusionary logics that are embedded in freedom of movement directives. Mm. Because basically, if you look at freedom of movement law, it's very clear that this is a conditional right.
Yeah.
And therefore, it does privilege the movement of people with sufficient resources to support themselves, which in and of itself creates some inequalities in who can move and who cannot move. And the issue with the UK and at least one other European country is that they never enforced the conditional right. Mm. And now I think quite understandably we're starting to see the inequalities within the people who moved under the guise of freedom of movement, even though actually they didn't meet the conditional terms. But the failure to address that previously by sociologists and by scholars of intra-EU mobility is precisely because they'd never really, I don't know, this could be a bit too scathing and too damning, but they didn't really look at what that was facilitating that was not strictly what the directive said in the first place. I realise I'm kind of talking around the houses a little bit, but it's really, really clear to me that actually even among migration scholars, there's very little understanding that freedom of movement was a conditional right, and it wasn't a free-for-all, I think is what I'm trying to say there. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that even though it was a conditional right, and we know how law works in principle and how law works in practice are quite different things. So people moved and they weren't scrutinized for those rights. And so people thought, oh, well, they have this privilege, when actually they didn't have that privilege. It was just privilege because somebody was looking the other way. I've been struggling to kind of articulate it in a way. And that is not me saying, OK, well, we should have checked more carefully previously. It's me saying, OK, if you take freedom of movement as a free right for anyone to move and settle anywhere they want to with no conditions, then of course you might think it's a privilege. But actually, that privilege wasn't actually universal in the way that people believe. And we can see that through the case of Roma and the removal of Roma populations who'd moved within Europe, which I think people don't really ever think about. So the question is, if freedom of movement was free for all, why are these people being asked to leave? Well, they're being asked to leave through the enforcement of a legal instrument, which is basically that they did not meet the conditional rights to be somewhere. So that inequality was there, it's just that people didn't see it.
Yes, this reminds me a little bit of a recent event with people from the Commission, where I was mentioning this, the topic of EU migration. Of course, the Commission doesn't call migration, it calls freedom movement. And the answer was, will people like the freedom to, you know, be able to take a flight and go somewhere else? It's a specific way of looking at freedom of movement, because it's not, you know, if you look at the experience of people who actually move, they leave their lives to actually go somewhere else. It's very much shaped, and this is what we discuss in the article, by how, you know, austerity in Europe is affecting different countries in different ways. So, you know, quantitative terms, if you look at the flows of migration from countries to other countries, it goes very much from Southern Europe, Eastern Europe to core countries, say. And this also, you know, has symbolic implications of people shaping certain countries as backwards, certain countries as more advanced. But also we need to think about that migration served the economic structure of this country in many respects. So by providing skilled migrants for free, all these, you know, skilled migrants come here, obviously are an addition to the British economic system, and also provide low-skill migrants that the system needs. It keeps the salaries low. So what we try to do is actually to say migration was one of the few things that, you know, people from the periphery had to actually have a job within Europe. And it's very much about how resources are distributed within Europe. So if you decide to leave the European project, you don't have European migrants maybe depressing your salaries, but you're basically controlling more, you know, you're controlling your resources, you're actually making a statement about the distribution of resources within the EU. All these debates should be, yes, basically broaden outside the UK in order to really capture what inequality is to do.
So what do you think? I mean, you've mentioned a few times this idea of a core and a periphery to Europe. And I wonder if you could just spell out a little bit more what you mean by that. And what I suppose really what you're talking about is power relations.
Yeah, so it comes originally from world system theory, Wallerstein, and the following readings of Wallerstein, because, of course, there have been critiques within race theory. But also, I think for us, one of the illuminating points was coming across Stuart's whole article. It's an article on how Gramsci can be used for race theory. And it's a very interesting use of hegemony in relation to ethnicity in Gramsci's work. So how Gramsci talks about hegemonic relations, and he talks about this, within Europe even before the start of the EU project. So, I could see that the connections with the world system theory. World system theory is obviously more applied at the global level, where, there is a division between countries that have more power in relation to their capitalist development. So capitalism is based by, divisions, inequalities in relation to power, economic power. I'm talking specifically about material power in this case. And certain countries hold more power and therefore have a more advanced development in the capitalist economy, and they can basically use these advantages. This is applied at a global level, but you can use it also with regional constructions, so for example, within Europe. And in fact, we found quite developed literature on core periphery inequalities within Europe that preceded the creation of the EU and then was developed through the existence of the European project. So it's really about understanding how capitalism distributes resources in an equal way, how certain structures reinforce this this division between countries that have more power and countries that have less power.
We were also concerned with connecting the material side of the core periphery dynamic, the inequalities, with the symbolic side, and that Gramsci was very helpful, but also, like with many papers, there was a lot of backstage discussion and literatures that then don't get into the article, which is the front stage. So, for example, there was a lot of discussion in terms of decolonial theory and how it actually has considered dynamics within Europe in terms of forms of racialization and how southern and eastern European populations get, in a sense, racialized and so imagined as less developed, less competent, less modern. So people like Walter Mignolo, for example, wrote about this stuff. So this stuff was in our discussions. But then, of course, for various issues, including space in a journal articles, all this stuff kind of stayed backstage. But yeah, we were basically trying to connect the more materialist, economist side of world system theory with certain debates about basically how world system dynamics racialize and have symbolic effects.
And I think your point about racialization of EU citizens is also a point very well made. Particularly, I mean, people are very familiar with the racialization, I think, of some of the more recent accession states. Citizens, particularly when they come to the UK. But I think that you offer a much more complex narrative than one that just says, okay, well, people from this state are racialized in this way. Do you want to reflect on that a little bit more?
I think about the case of Italy. At the moment, especially before Brexit, there is no evidence, for example, that Italians suffer any form of structural discrimination in the UK. But at the same time, it's interesting how Italians talk about themselves, Italian migrants, for example. They talk about themselves frequently. There's a discussion about the fact of being not as modern as northern European countries. So ideas about corruption, ideas about nepotism, these tend to be connected, especially in Italian political debates, to issues of Italian culture. So we are this way because this is our culture. So we have a bad culture, we have to get modern. So it's very difficult not to read these debates, these public discourses, for me at least, in terms of racialization. And again, going back to the colonial theory. And again, it's something we were familiar, perhaps also from personal experience. I don't know if you want to...
We can add something maybe about also the fact that this reflects the position of other countries being taken as a model. It's really interesting to see how Britain feels... an outsider within the European project. But if you go to the in Brussels, the UK has been very influential in shaping, you know, some of the most important policies. And it's very interesting to see how this is not discussed. The British are not aware of their important influence outside Britain, like how they massively shaped, you know, the single market, the concept, how they massively shaped the Lisbon agenda. So this idea that everyone has to upskill, has to go to higher education, which was a very dominating, I think, narrative where we were growing up, and it became very dominating in Eastern Europe. So everyone has to get a degree was very much a narrative in our 20s, I think. I see. On the other side, I think also what we do in the article is to make a little bit more complex this idea that of EU migrants in relation to race, because the assumption that all EU migrants are white is also doesn't take into consideration the fact that the Mediterranean is the first stepping point when you want to access Europe. So we have an increasing number of migrants that are black, and it's also related to other forms of inequality. But it's also important to say that, and yes, personally, I think in terms of our biographies, I think for example, during the Brexit debate, I was living in Newcastle at that time because I was working at Teesside, and I saw myself, the flags saying, migrants go home. So I remember to actually have experienced some of the, troubled forms of discussions and arguments in a square in Newcastle once. So there was a lot of debate about the role of migration. And also having conversations with people that say, no, the problem is not you. No, you're not you, the migrant that is a problem. That also puts your own self into question. Why am I not the problem? Because I have a good job, because I have an education. What makes me better than other migrants? Of course, it was also my problem. I think it was the problem of all migrants at that time. EU migrants and non-EU migrants, actually. Non-EU migrants have been very much the target of Brexit hatred. I think we also discussed that, because that was an important point made by Bamber, I think.
One of the things that you do really well is bring all of this together and point out that, first of all, there's the inequalities of those different states and the different stakes that they have in Europe, and how that then translates into experiences, perhaps, of people originating in those states or with citizenship of those states when they're in the UK. But I think that you also are very keen to make sure that the scale doesn't stop there, that it isn't a scale that just understands the individual, perhaps, from the point of view of one nation state, but also that there are inequalities within nation states. And I thought it was really admirable the way that you tried to actually draw that out, because I think we can, as you pointed out before, we can get stuck at one scale almost. So this idea of kind of unequal Europe seemed to be matched by an idea of unequal Europeans as well, which I think I really appreciated, particularly as I've been trying to write about that in terms of the kind of unequalness, the unevenness of the effects of Brexit on British populations who live abroad, who are equally diverse in terms of class, in terms of race, in terms of ethnicity, in terms of age, gender, and things like that. I suppose my kind of closing question is to ask you what this actually does. What does starting from a point where we understand how individuals are unevenly positioned across those different scales mean for how we do research about Brexit? Because I think that that's been something that's been, it's a kind of a challenging question, because I think that there is a danger, and I feel this quite acutely myself, there is really a danger that we reproduce precisely the narratives that have been at the heart of the Brexit debate through these analyses. And I am quite alarmed by the extent to which the record does do that, the record that's been produced so far. So I suppose I'm asking, for you, how do you imagine going forwards this research on Brexit, particularly a kind of a critical sociology of Brexit, might take shape? I suppose it's like, what's your dream, I suppose, but because I think it has quite significant methodological, conceptual and theoretical implications, this idea of these inequalities and this idea of positioning Brexit back into Britain's relationship with the European Union, whatever that might be.
It makes me think especially about migration at this point, and also having a background in qualitative methods, I will probably talk about that. But it makes me think about the importance of any project about, for example, the impact of Brexit on European migrants. You have to be very careful about who are the people you talk with and how do you choose those people. Because, again, when we look at the previous literatures, there was an assumption that you just sample, so to speak, a certain national and ethnic group. And that's pretty much it. Or you sample that group, you get a very diverse sample, but analytically you don't expand on that. So there are actually articles before Brexit about European migration that I think show quite clearly dynamics of inequality. It's just that inequality wasn't the main story of those articles. So you can see the data there, but you can see the author is not using the data. So at least for me, it's a question of who are the people you talk with and making sure that you select those people in a way that is informed by a concept of inequality.
I think we talk a little bit about how do we use this work. So it could be used, as Simone said, as a conceptual tool for other people doing research on these topics and to help in understanding the meaning of the qualitative material that they collect, because sometimes the qualitative material is presented uncritically without, you know, being put into context. Maybe taking into account the positionality of the country would also help to understand the meaning of what you know, the participants are saying. We also talk, I think, about could we do like research that compares, say, British working class experiences with EU migrants' working class experiences that draw actually comparisons and actually find connections and find differences. So actually maybe comparing different groups within the same country, because sometimes, as we said, you know, EU migration is not connected to wider debates or inequalities, but if you want to bring these two things together, you could think about a project trying to link, you know, all different people from different ethnic groups, but having similar sort of experiences. I think that would be very interesting. And as someone who does kind of mixed methods research, so I enjoy doing the qualitative. And I also think about how can we generalize from the quantitative. Unfortunately, most of the research at the moment, the quantitative research is on Brexit voting, because that's where we get the data from, because we have, like, especially with the data we use, is about political intentions. So EU migrants are systematically excluded by that. It would be very interesting to actually do something that overcomes this quantitative methodological gap and actually draw more specific inferences. Mm-hmm. And also, I think there's another point that we make in the conclusion of the article, which is this is valid for other countries that are considering exiting the EU, because there are, of course, Euroscepticism is not just a British thing. It's widespread across Europe. It's rising in core countries, countries of the periphery for different reasons. You know, I always think about comparative cross-national research that can actually maybe, you know, compare a core country Euroscepticism with a periphery country's Euroscepticism and understand a little bit what are the different drivers, because I think the drivers are quite different.
And also, I think what they tend to do, those, because there is work that does multiple countries, but they never then consider the power relation of where, of how people are positioned, not people, the states are positioned and their stake in Europe within that. So I think you've offered a really useful just starting off point, actually, for thinking about how we might reconceptualize what is, I hope, the beginning of a critical sociology of Brexit. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Miguel.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Brexit Brits Abroad podcast, hosted by me, Dr. Michaela Benson, and produced by Emma Halton at Art of Podcast. The series is part of a UK and a Changing Europe-funded research project, Brexit Brits Abroad, that's all about what Brexit means for UK citizens living in the EU27. We're really keen to hear from you about the issues and concerns we address in the programme, so please do get in touch with any thoughts, queries and questions. You can find our contact details on our webpage, Brexit Brits Abroad, or get in touch via social media. We're on Twitter at BrexpatsEU, and we have a Facebook page, Brexit Brits Abroad. Finally, in case you're not already subscribed to the podcast, you can do so on both iTunes and Google Podcasts. Thank you for listening, and I'll be back in a couple of weeks with the next episode.